And without further ado, let me tell you a little bit about Douglas Crockford. This is the guy, and it's kind of nice to introduce someone who has his own Wikipedia page, although apparently you can't work on your own Wikipedia page yourself. But he's got a Wikipedia page, so you could look him up if you like. The one thing that they referenced there is Jason, although when I asked him, he said, I discovered Jason. It was already out there. It just needed to be seen and then, of course, popularized. I first encountered him with the book JavaScript, The Good Parts, which I thought was a great title because my immediate thought was, there are good parts? But there were good parts, and I think it was a foundation that's turned JavaScript into an incredibly important language today, and I think we can thank Mr. Crockford for that, and I hope you'll all put your hands together for Douglas Crockford.
Hey, good morning, everybody. It's great to be here, isn't it? Sure it is. So I'm going to start by introducing you to this guy. This is Edsger Dijkstra, the first Dutch computer programmer. Here he is at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco in 1972, where he is accepting the Turing Award of the ACM and giving a speech called The Humble Programmer. Really interesting speech. It's worth taking a look at. It's available on YouTube and some other sources. It was interesting at the time because a lot of what he said was a little inflammatory and definitely not mainstream stuff. It rubbed a lot of feathers the wrong way. And almost everything he said, from our perspective, was true. And it's really neat when you can do that, when you can go against the mainstream and say things which are unpopular, and then history proves that you are right. He only got one thing wrong in the talk, and we'll talk about that later, but basically it's a really interesting talk, and parts of it are funny. He was given the award because of the interesting work he had done. He'd done the first work in concurrency and threading and mutual exclusion. We can do threads today because of stuff that Dijkstra figured out with his semaphores. He did work in concurrent garbage collection in operating systems, and language design. He was on the committee that did ALGOL 60, which was the best design by committee of a programming language in history. But he is most famous for having written a letter to the editor of the communications of the ACM. And I want to show you part of that letter. The editor added the title to the letter, Go To Considered Harmful. And he begins, for a number of years, I've been familiar with the observation that the quality of programmers is a decreasing function of the density of go-to statements in the programs they produce. Now, he's observing that go-to is bad, which turns out to be absolutely correct. But what's interesting about the way he says this is he's not complaining about the programs that have go-to, he's complaining about the people who use go-to. This is the most rude, arrogant way I think you could present this argument. In fact, it's been suggested that arrogance should be measured in micro-Dijkstras. That we should love the coder but hate the code, right? He gets this wrong, gets it wrong. But we continue. More recently, I discovered why the use of the go-to statement has such disastrous effects. So not only is he arrogant, he's a drama queen. Right, he's talking about disaster. It's maybe a metaphor here, but I think he means it literally. He thinks it's really a disaster. And he continues, I became convinced that the go-to statement should be abolished in all higher level programming languages. And this launched an argument that went on for over 20 years. And it was a loud, noisy argument, very emotional, deeply divisive argument. So let's look at the argument. So Dijkstra here is a radical, and he's proposing a major change, that there is one statement in our languages that should be removed, eliminated from all languages, replaced with blocks. The reactionaries go, whoa, 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 you can't do that. And they come up with a big set of reasons for why you can't do that. First, they talk about performance, that there are certain idioms which are more efficiently expressed using go-to, and we really need that efficiency. And at the time that they were doing that, machines were still pretty expensive and very slow and small by modern standards. So there might have been something there, but it turned out, if you looked closely at it, there really wasn't. There was an argument about tradition. We have always had go-to. From the beginning of time, there has been go-to. Our grandfathers had go-to. You can't take go-to away from us. It's part of what we are. Then there's a freedom argument. I need the freedom to use the go-to. I have rights. You cannot deny me my rights. There is a pride argument that you're saying that bad programs get written with go-to. That's an insult, sir. I can write good programs with go-to. You're not talking about me. This is... And then there's the majority argument. There are more of us using go-to than there are of you radicals, so obviously we must be right, right? Majority rules. Truth is determined always by the majority. And then there is a meta argument. Our list is longer than your list, so there. Then in between, there are the moderates. The moderates are saying, okay, we understand both sides of the argument. Clearly, we should be avoiding the go-to where possible because we want to avoid disasters, of course, but it's sometimes useful, and so we don't want to give it away. Let's all be nice, and we'll just keep using the go-to. And this went on and on for over 20 years. And it was a really emotional argument. You know, as programmers, we think of ourselves as being rational, right? And all of our arguments for why we program one way versus another, they're all rational arguments, except it turns out they're not. They're usually emotional arguments. And this went on and on. And I remember when this was going on. I started programming in 71, so I'm at the beginning of this, and I watch it go. And it went on for such a long time because we didn't change minds. We had to wait for a generation to retire or die before we could get critical mass on this really good idea. And the whole time they were saying, you can't take this away from us. But what Dijkstra was actually offering them was a better way to write programs. It was actually a gift. It was an offering. But they refused to look at it that way. And it went on and on. Eventually, it got kind of quiet. It's like, are they gone? Can we get rid of the go-to now? Okay, good. And we got rid of it. And it turns out all of the things that the reactionaries were saying about how awful it would be to get rid of the go-to, none of that turned out. And everything's fine now. So it turns out that progress does not wait for the next new idea. It waits for consensus on an old idea. That we have this mythology about our profession that we just leap from one good idea to the next, and the thing that's holding us back is waiting for the next good idea to be thought of. And once that happens, then boom, we all move forward together. And that's not the way it happens. I wish it did, but that's not what happens. So if we look at the history of the go-to, so Dijkstra publishes his letter in 1968. And he says that this idea was first presented to him in 1959, when the Algol committee was meeting. There was someone on the committee who said, maybe we shouldn't put a go-to in the language. And at the time, that struck him as really strange. How could it work without a go-to? It didn't make sense. Almost a decade later, he's been thinking about it and going, God, that guy was right. So he publishes his letter. C comes out in 73. Dennis Ritchie is a moderate. He doesn't use go-to himself or not very much, but he doesn't think that the language will be viable if he leaves a go-to out, so he puts a go-to in it. C++ comes out a few years later. C++ also has go-to in it. 1995, Java comes out. Java does not have go-to. And boom, Java is the most successful introduction of a new programming language in history, and finally, we're free of go-to. Except if you look at the design of Java, go-to is still a reserved word. Okay, they're hedging their bets. And also, they still have statement labels in the language, even though they're not necessary anymore. Every statement can have a label. Just in case it turned out to be wrong, they could go, okay, Java 1.1, go-to's back. Fortunately, we didn't demand that they do that, but they were worried about it. They were worried about it. So this stuff goes slowly. So the thing that Dijkstra talked about in his talk that didn't pan out was proofs of correctness. They were observing the software crisis, where as machines were getting bigger and faster, it was getting harder to make programs. It was expected it would be easier, but it was getting harder, and it was because the programs were getting more complex, and we were not good at managing the complexity of those programs. And so the software crisis, that programs would be developed that were buggy, that wouldn't work well, sometimes never got finished, and this was considered to be a big problem. And in fact, it's still a problem. We've made virtually no progress on that problem. We still make bugs. So being a mathematician, or being trained as a mathematician, he thought that the way out of this was proofs of correctness, that if we can apply the same mathematical rigor to programming as we do to mathematics, that, you know, just as we can take a formula and produce a proof for it, we should be able to take a program and produce a proof for it. And there was a lot of optimism that this could work. They recognized early on that testing is not effective. Dijkstra says that tests can only prove the existence of bugs, not their absence. And testing was not the way to get out of the software crisis. He thought rigorous proofs were. Turned out it didn't work, because the proofs are invariably more complex than the programs are trying to prove. And since the problem is that we can't manage the complexity, we couldn't manage the proofs. That's even harder. And so it didn't happen. So that didn't work. For example, Knuth published a program that contained this comment, "Beware of bugs in the above code. I've only proved it correct, not tried it." So, you know, what to do? Well, someone got the idea that maybe we can, since proofs didn't work, maybe there's another avenue. Maybe we can do things with types. Types first find their way into programming in Fortran. In assembly language, a word could contain some bits, and that bits could indicate an integer or a real word or a real number or some characters or an address or an instruction. There's no way of telling by just looking at the bits what it was going to be. The instructions would determine how the bits would be interpreted. When we start writing Fortran, we have variables, and we want to be able to add something, whether it's an integer or a real or whatever. And so types start to find their way into programming languages. And there's this idea, maybe having enforcement of types in the programming language can do what the proofs of correctness tried to do and failed. There's a brilliant guy, Robin Milner, who created a brilliant language called ML, who was a big proponent of this typing theory. And he said that well-typed programs cannot go wrong, which unfortunately is not true, that it's really easy for well-typed programs to go very wrong, that the class of potential errors is infinitely bigger than the class of errors that can be discovered by the world's best type system, even the world's best theoretical type system. But there is an argument that's still going on today. So you've got radicals who are saying that type checking, as currently offered, is not worth the freight, that it actually makes programming harder, that it induces its own errors, that because the type system doesn't want you doing things that you must do, it causes you to make mistakes as you work around it. Then there are the reactionaries who say, well, that's all wrong, that types actually do work, that they do require a little extra effort, but it's helping you. You're actually saving time over the long run. And all of these arguments are offered without any evidence at all. And then there are the moderates who say, well, it's all a matter of taste. You know, if you like types, you should use types. If you don't, you shouldn't have to. There are some who even argue that you can use types and not use types in the same program at the same time, which I think is totally silly, but you know, that's a popular point of view. What is the right answer? We don't know yet, right? We're not going to know for another 20 years what the right answer to this is. But I'm a radical, so I think that it's not worth the freight yet. I'm hoping that maybe someday it will. So I encourage research in types, see if we can figure out a way to make Milner's promise come true. But we're not there yet, and there's no evidence yet that we will get there. Now, while the go-to argument was going on, there was a joke about the come-from statement. The joke was that while we're getting rid of the go-to statement, we should also get rid of the come-from statement. And there were proposals about what the come-from statement should be and ideas about designing new languages just to put a come-from statement into it so we could then eliminate it. But it turns out that in most modern languages, there is a come-from statement. We just spell it differently. In modern languages, we spell it extends. What extends does is cause this really tight coupling between components. And we know that that kind of coupling causes big architectural problems, makes the code brittle, makes architectural modification difficult. And so any language that has come from is actually problematic. And it would make sense to eliminate come from in the same way that we eliminated go to. So what's the alternative? If you're not doing stuff with come from, then you probably want to be doing functional programming. Functional programming is an old, long-established paradigm which is just now starting to find its way into the mainstream. And JavaScript is an interesting language in that it's doing the functional thing and the object-oriented thing at the same time in a really interesting way. But it's such an expressive language that you can do it one way or the other, and that's creating gulfs and traps and other weirdness. So we can look at the history of functional programming. It starts in 1958 with John McCarthy at MIT working on a Lisp processing language called Lisp. His original plan for Lisp is to create an Algol-like language which has a couple of affordances in it for doing artificial intelligence programming. But his students loved his intermediate representation, which he called S expressions, which were just things wrapped in parentheses, nested structures. He never intended for normal people to have to ever see those, but his students really liked that they could write programs using those and that the programs represent the same data structures that the language is trying to manipulate that. And so he was kind of stuck with that idea. Then someone suggested that he add something called Lambda, which was something that Alonzo Church had been working on. McCarthy didn't really understand the Lambda calculus, but he just put it in, and Lisp becomes a functional language. Milner creates his ML language, which is a big improvement over Lisp, adding a really interesting type system. Scheme is invented at MIT in 1975. Scheme was developed as an attempt to try to understand Carl Hewitt's actor model. And Scheme failed to do that, but accidentally discovered the way to do functional programming correctly, which was something that was incorrect in Lisp, but Scheme gets it right. Functions as first-class objects with lexical closure, the most important discovery in the history of programming, and as always happens with the really important fundamental discoveries, the world took no notice of it at all. Just nothing happened. The Lisp community eventually recognized that Scheme got that right, so about a decade later when they start to standardize Lisp, because Lisp had fragmented into lots of separate implementations, so they tried to bring it all back, and they adopted the way that Scheme did its functions, because that was the right way to do it. Not that it mattered. Again, the world didn't pay any attention to that. Haskell's developed in 1990, the successor to ML. Haskell attempts to be a pure functional programming language, which sort of increases the level of difficulty. Some interesting stuff there, and it might pay off someday, but it hasn't yet. Then in 1999, JavaScript is the first language to take the functions from Scheme and deliver them effectively to the mainstream, which is an amazing accomplishment. JavaScript did that. JavaScript was followed by Ruby and Python and C Sharp, and then eventually Java figured out how to do this. And today, almost every language now knows how to do functions of one sort or another, but it took a long time to get there. And the industry still hasn't fully bought into this idea, even though it really is the smart way to be going forward. Now, JavaScript is mostly a functional language. It's missing just one thing. But it was specified in ES6, so we should get it soon. It's a thing called proper tail calls. This is the single most important new feature that was added in ES6. Proper tail calls means that if a function returns the result of calling another function, instead of the compiler generating a call return, it should generate a jump, which means that now Recursive functions should run at the same speed as functions that are written using loops, which is great. It means we can do continuation passing style. We can do lots of new forms of programming, which are good and important, and we need it in this language. Unfortunately, none of the JavaScript engines have implemented it yet. This looks like it's going to be the last feature implemented. And we need it. It's overdue. So if you happen to see anybody from Microsoft, I understand this place is lousy with them. So if you see one of those guys, I'd like you to go up to him very, very nicely and say, please get on the stick and get us proper tail calls pronto. Thank you. Because we need it. Microsoft was the last company to finish ES5. Microsoft has an opportunity to be the first company to finish ES6. I think they should absolutely jump on that. One of the interesting side effects of proper tail calls when we get it is that it makes JavaScript even better as a virtual machine. JavaScript has become the world's most popular virtual machine, which is weird because it was not intended to be that at all. But people are now translating Java into JavaScript in order to allow it to run everywhere. And one of the things that the people who are doing that, people are inventing entirely new languages to compile into JavaScript so that it can get the portability. And one of the features that they have asked for is a go-to statement, because they don't want to be stuck with JavaScript's control structures. They think of JavaScript as an assembly language, and they want to be able to generate their own control structures and have things jump anywhere they want. And we won't do that. We don't want to put go-to in the language, because we know that if we do, some idiot web developer is going to go, hey, go-to. And then we're going to have to wait for another generation to die, right? And so we don't want to do that. But we can put proper tail calls in the language, which means that the guys writing those compilers and code generators, they've got a very nicely parameterized, structured go-to, which allows them to get the efficiency and the flexibility that they need. They can generate code, which is still good. And if Microsoft implements this feature, it'll run really fast. So let's get that pronto. So back again. So SSL is the security layer of the web, and unfortunately, it is very complex and is still wildly buggy even after 20 years of debugging. Relevant to this talk, this is an example of some code that was in iOS's implementation of SSL, which was discovered a year or two ago. And this code broke SSL so that a man in the middle could take over systems and do bad things, really bad stuff. And this is the statement, the actual code from that program. And you can look at this code, and there's a lot of stuff wrong with it. So let's look at what's wrong with this. First, they're using an assignment in expression position. We should never do that, right? We should only use assignment in statement position. There's this idea that if we use assignment as an expression, we can be just a little bit sneakier and faster and stuff, but it's not. There's no advantage, and it makes the code much harder to understand, which may have led to this problem. A bigger problem is that there's an if statement without a block as a consequence. It's using just a naked statement as a block, as a consequence. You should never do that. Every if statement, every while, every for, every else, everything should have blocks. Because if you don't, this happens. There's a copy and paste error. Go-to is in there twice, which means that the first one will be executed conditionally, and the second one will be executed unconditionally, which means it'll always fail. Another error, which is harder to see from this snippet, is that the fail label isn't actually the fail case. It's the exit case. So it'll exit the function, returning the error variable as its value. And in this case, if the test goes the wrong way, we actually leave successfully, but having skipped over all the important stuff that this function was supposed to do. Then there's an obvious copy and paste error that go-to fail was repeated. You don't want that. Had curly braces been in there, then that would not have caused a problem. But the biggest problem with this code is it's got a go-to in it. Who is still using go-to in the 21st century? How is this even possible? And what this is evidence of is that if you allow people to do stupid things in a programming language, there will be people who will say, I'm going to do that. So remembering the really rude thing that Dijkstra said about people who use GoTo, I think he was right. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think he was right. So all of these things are examples of a paradigm shift. You can recognize a paradigm shift argument where someone says, I have never blank, so I don't see why blank. For example, I have never avoided using GoTo, so I don't see why we should be doing structured programming. Or I've never used functions, so I don't understand why we should use functional programming. The way these arguments work is that you think you understand the argument because you understand all of the words of the argument. But what's missing is an experiential aspect of it, that if you haven't done programming without go-tos or without this or some other newfangled thing, you think you understand the argument, but you don't. And so when you go into an argument unprepared in that way, then you're not going to get the right conclusion, and the argument never stops. You know, until at some point you've actually done the experiment and tried it and lived with it long enough to get through the paradigm shift, and then once you're on the other side, now you're in a place where you can evaluate and say, well, that was good, but it wasn't good enough, or that kind of thing. But without the experience, you cannot correctly determine it. So the thing which holds us back as an industry, as a profession, is that we have a really tough time distinguishing between a paradigm shift and a really bad idea. We can't tell. Until you've actually done the experiment, you can't tell. And we get this wrong in both directions. For example, there was this XML thing that happened a few years ago. And a lot of people thought, I'm getting right through the paradigm shift. This XML, that's the next thing. And the people who don't get it, you know, they're just on the wrong side. And it turned out, no, that one wasn't a paradigm shift. It was just a bad idea. We really can't tell. And so, you know, this stuff takes a long time. So I want to tell you one more story, and it's baseball, right? Anybody heard of baseball? Anybody? A few hands go up. So you may have heard this story. It's from a book called Moneyball by Michael Lewis. Really good book. Highly recommend it. It's also made into a movie with Brad Pitt. Really good movie. You should see that, too. Who saw the movie? Anybody? Okay. So, yeah. So it was good, wasn't it? Everyone like it? Good? Yeah. So it's about a guy named Bill James. Bill James is a fan, and he loves statistics. So he's capturing all these baseball statistics and analyzing them, and often analyzing them in ways unlike the way other analysts have done it. One of the things he's looking for is statistics which reveal how it is that a team wins. You know, are there some numbers, is there some formula which can determine who a winner is going to be, and why are they winners? And so he's crunching the numbers, and he comes up with some really interesting findings, that he thinks he has discovered something fundamental and profound about the game that nobody else understands. And he publishes, and he's trying to get attention. And he thinks that people who should have the most interest in what he's doing are the people who own baseball clubs, because if they can understand his model, then they should be able to win more easily, and that, you know, everyone wants to win. And they just reject him, say, no, you don't understand the game. You know, the game is all about, it's all about mystery and tradition and nuance, that the only way you understand baseball is by experience and love of the game, that you can't reduce it to numbers. You know, this guy is just a night guardsman or a security guy at a pork and beans cannery factory, doesn't know anything about baseball. In fact, he is, but he actually knows quite a lot about baseball. So go forward a little bit in time. Billy Beane is the general manager of the Oakland A's. And the A's have a problem. Oakland is not a large city, and it's not a wealthy city. So the budgets that are available to the A's are a tiny fraction of the budgets that are available to other teams like the New York Yankees. And so they have a really difficult time recruiting players because they can't match the salaries. So they'll go and discover people who all the other teams have overlooked, and they'll bring them in and develop them. And when these guys turn out to be stars, then the next season the Yankees come and lure them away with bigger salaries, and now they're playing against you. It's getting harder and harder every year. So Bean decides to take a look at the sabermetric stuff and thinks that maybe it's worth giving it a try because he doesn't have any other options. So what sabermetrics taught him was don't make outs. If you can avoid making outs, that's 90% of the game. Because when you're up at bat, for that half of the inning, you can score runs until you get three outs, and then you can't anymore. That closes all opportunities to score. So you need to get as many runs as you can before the end of the inning. And the way you do that is by not making outs. If you can figure out how to not make outs, then you're more likely to win. So there's a great scene, stealing bases is one of the things it turns out you shouldn't do. Stealing bases is one of the most popular plays in baseball, because baseball tends to be really boring. You know, it's a lot of time spent, nothing happening. But you get this little unexpected moment of action when base stealing happens, where a runner can do something slightly out of turn and at great risk, but there's a chance that he can advance a base. And when he does it, everybody's really happy. Wow, he did that. You know, way to go, you did that. But it's a risky move because sometimes you can get thrown out and then, but tough luck, but great try, really good. You know, maybe next time you'll make it. So everybody loves stealing bases, but it turns out if you look at the numbers, if you're successful in advancing the base, then you accumulate 1/4 potential run. If you're unsuccessful, you lose 1/4 potential run and you get an out. And that out means that you have decreased the likelihood of any of the next players being able to get on base and score. And so when you add it all up, it turns out it's a losing bet. So in most cases, you should never steal second. So there's a scene in the movie where Bean is trying to explain these new principles to his players, and he's telling them that they shouldn't be stealing bases. And one of his star players stops him and says, well, wait a minute, that's what you hired me for. He says, no, I hired you to get on first, not to get thrown out at second. So we're not going to steal bases. So that's a negative. So what's the positive thing? What is it that we should be doing instead? Need to be getting on base. Need to be getting on base. That's the whole thing. So we want to be recruiting players who can get on base. Because if you can get on base, that means you didn't get an out and you get 1/4 potential run. And if you can keep doing that, if you can sustain that, then you get real runs and you win. So one of the ways that you can get on base is to walk. A walk happens if there are 4 bad pitches that happen before 3 strikes. And before sabermetrics, it was thought that the player has nothing to do with that happening, that that's just the pitcher screwing up. So it's nice that we get the walk, yeah, but it's not exciting, and it doesn't tell us anything about the performance of the batter. But it turns out that that's not the case, that getting walked a lot is actually a skill, because it means that you can look at that ball that's coming at you and make a determination that it's going to go outside and not swing. And it turns out that's an unusual skill, and it is a skill, and the people who are able to do that get walked more. And walking is great. It's not just this, oh, well, that happened. It means that you're guaranteed to get to first without an out. And if you had someone on first, they're guaranteed to get to second without an out. And if bases were loaded, then you get a run. Guaranteed. You don't have to worry about someone tripping and falling or any accident, you know, any weird thing that could happen. Guaranteed you score. That's great. And so the A's started recruiting people who could get walked. And so as they're building their team, they're looking for, first, players who are cheap, players that the other teams aren't interested in, who have this strange particular skill that they can get on base. And that's the only thing they can do. Some of these guys can't run, can't throw, can't catch, but they can get on base. Some of them were considered to be too old or too crippled to be playing baseball anymore. The A's hired them. And it worked. So that year, they almost get the pennant, which was kind of amazing for a team which was priced out of the game, right? That it worked, and it changed the way that people think about the game. So how do we apply this to programming? So if we could take programming and reduce it to one principle, you know, one thing which is 90% of what we should be doing, if we could do that, could we increase it? And I think we can. Don't make bugs. Because bugs are bad, right? Bugs are bad for the organization because they have to deal with the consequence of the software not working, and sometimes those consequences can be disastrous, to use a phrase. But it also means that while we are tracking down and repairing the bugs, we're not doing useful work, right? So if we want to improve the effectiveness, then we need to make bugs. And that doesn't happen just accidentally. It means you have to refocus the entire effort. Everything that we're doing has to be focused on not making bugs. So we need to become software entomologists, right? We want to be studying bugs. Whenever they occur in our code, we don't just want to fix them and forget them. We want to understand, how did this happen? Where did this come from? How can we avoid this happening again? Everything gets about being smarter about not making bugs. So it means you don't steal bases, right? Whatever the equivalents are, things which are dangerous and reckless, which increase the drama of programming, no, we don't want to be doing that anymore. We want to be writing very simple, clean, clear programs which are less likely to have places where bugs can hide in them. Make sense? Yeah, so for example, if you're writing in JavaScript, it means everything you write passes JSLint, because JSLint was designed for trying to reduce errors that can occur in JavaScript, which is a language which promotes bug creation. Now, a lot of people don't want to use JavaScript or want to use JSLint because they consider it's too hard. But it's easier than fixing bugs, right? It's what it's for. There are other lint programs which give you options. What those options actually do for you is allow you to say, those bugs, I want those bugs in my code. Leave those bugs in my code. I don't care about those. JSLint doesn't give you those options. It's going to work or it's not. And I got to believe that what you are doing is important enough that you should be writing to that level of quality. So I'm going to close now, and then maybe we'll do a few questions. I want to leave you with one piece of advice, and I'm really serious about this. Please listen. Advice? Okay. Don't make bugs. Thank you. So I've got a little bit of time for questions if someone wants to shout something out. I'm sorry? What's the JSON story? Okay, so in 2001, I started a company called State Software. And we had an AJAX framework. We had an AJAX server and an AJAX client, except AJAX wouldn't be discovered for 4 years, and so we were a little bit early to market. So we had a really difficult time convincing people that you could write real programs in JavaScript. Just couldn't make that case yet. And we needed to be able to communicate between our client that was written in JavaScript and our server that was written in Java. So we needed a language-independent way of doing that. So Java serialization, for example, wouldn't work. The thing that everybody else was doing, XML, and we looked at that and said, that's just totally ridiculous. It's so complicated, and it assumes a model which is incompatible with the inherent model of programming languages. It's just totally ineffective. So I got this wild idea that we could use JavaScript object literals. So, and it worked, you know, that we could use eval in the browser to parse our JSON messages. The first name we had for the thing was JSML, JavaScript markup language. Fortunately, there was something else called JSML, so we didn't use that. Then we came up with JSON, and that name stuck. And so we went around to our prospective customers and said, well, this is how we do the data communication. We've got a simple thing called JSON. The messages go, whoop, whoop, whoop. It's really nice. And they said, oh, we can't use that. We've just committed to XML. And so we have to use XML, sorry. And besides, it's not a standard. So I said, it's part of JavaScript. And they said, that's not a standard. So I went out and I bought JSON.org. And I declared that it was a standard. And that's it. And it became a standard. And it became a standard not because anybody was pushing it, but because you guys recognized, oh, this is so much better than XML, and it just happened by itself, which was really great. So there's now a formal standard. ECMA published a standard called ECMA 404, which is the official JSON standard. But it's irrelevant. Basically, we all figured out what JSON is. I mean, the nice thing about JSON was that the definition of the syntax of the standard fits on the back of a business card. So it may be the smallest standard ever produced, or potentially could have been, which I thought was a really nice thing. Because I think standards should be very small and minimal. That the less we have to agree on in order to interoperate, the more likely we're going to successfully interoperate. And JSON gets that really nice and small. Thank you. Anybody else? What's my opinion on TypeScript? I don't use it. TypeScript does not solve a problem that I have. It's probably the best written and designed of all the JavaScript front ends, but it doesn't provide any value to me, so I don't use it. It does a couple of things. One is, it is helping to advance the standard, so there are some features that were in ES6 that weren't in implementations yet, and so TypeScript got you to some of that early. Things like the ellipsis operator, which I think is really, really good. But the class thing, I think, is just a tragic mistake. That class was definitely in advance. You know, as we go from structured programming to object-oriented programming and then whatever's coming next, we are overdue on the next thing. And it's because we got fixated on classes, so much so that we have no perspective. We cannot see how classes are actually getting in our way. And I think the most effective way of using JavaScript is to get into the functional stuff. So the thing that's interesting about JavaScript is that we've got functions and dynamic objects, and now with ES5, we can freeze those objects, which is not like any language we've ever seen, and I think it is great, and I think it is the way forward. But if you're doing the class thing, then you're still stuck in the class paradigm, and you'll never move off of it. And unfortunately, by putting class into the language, a lot of people will feel vindicated. Yeah, well, class is in the language, therefore it had to have been a good idea, because they would never put a bad idea into the JavaScript language, right? That could never happen, except it happens quite a lot. TypeScript does nothing for me. I understand there are a few people here who like TypeScript, and that's fine. They don't work for me, so their jobs are probably safe. Anybody else? Yeah.
The people that developed the Apollo flight guidance system did a lot of study on bugs, and they found that 75% of their errors were in interfaces between modules. And so one of the things that things like TypeScript or interfaces do is provide typing to make sure that you clearly communicate what's expected in your interface. That seems to say that
That applies. I'm sorry, my memory isn't good enough that I can repeat what he said. But he's talking about using types to enforce module boundaries. And avoid bugs by enforcing those. I think that makes sense if you're in the classical paradigm, because it is such a brittle paradigm. But a similar argument was made for why JSON can't possibly work, because all JSON is doing is sending packets of descriptive stuff back and forth, and without schemas to enforce stuff at the boundaries, there is no way to build client-server or distributed systems using JSON. And it turns out not to be true.
I don't think it's not that you can't do it. The question is,
they said you can't do it.
Yeah, so the question is, are there more bugs introduced in those boundaries?
It depends on the paradigm. If you're working in a brittle paradigm, like classes, then yeah, because classes can go wrong so easily in so many ways that doing strong typing, well, for example, trying to do classical programming in JavaScript without the support of TypeScript is really, really hard, right? Because in that model, type errors happen almost constantly, right? And you really need the type system to help you get through it. But when you drop the class thing and just go objects and functions, then it just all goes away. So to it depends on what your interfaces are looking like, and if everything is properly loosely coupled, then I think the types aren't buying much.
So you don't think that you write algorithms that pre-assume types?
I don't.
Okay.
I want to be more flexible than that. I want it to be able to work with anything. So I'm not concerned with everything that's in an object. I'm only concerned with the stuff which is interesting to me at any moment. And that's a thing that JavaScript does really, really nicely. And then the rest of it is flexible and allows for other ways of composing things, things that you can't do in the strict classical model. Anybody else?
Yeah.
I'm sorry? After JSON what? Oh, what happens after classes and objects? I think the next thing is going to be better support for distributed programming. So all of the languages that we have today were all designed for sequential programming. And so everything is a variation on everything that came before since Fortran. But distributed programming is a completely different paradigm, and we are struggling with it now. We're not doing it very effectively because our languages don't understand it. So my intuition is that the next big breakthrough is going to be in languages that are designed specifically for distributed programming. And maybe that language already exists and we just haven't recognized it yet, or maybe we're still waiting for it to be invented. But I think that's the next big thing.
The Apollo Flight Guidance System work did objects with distributed programming built in. That was sort of, they've already solved that problem.
Great. Okay, so out of time, enjoy the break, have a great show.